Welcome to another critical episode of the Atomic Powered Supercast with your hosts, Andrew, David, and Jen. This week, our topic is Countdown to Infinite Crisis. And now the cast begins.
Okay, everybody, welcome to another well-timed episode of the Atomic Powered Supercast. Get it? Because countdown. It's funny in my head. My name's Andy, and I'm hanging out with Jen.
Hey.
And David.
Hey.
And this week we read Countdown to Infinite Crisis.
Yay.
So this is from May 2005. It's an 80-page, one-issue thing. And I didn't realize how many people were involved in creating this thing until I looked it up. So I'm going to read you the paragraph of the creators that are credited for this. The script was co-written by Jeff Johns, Greg Rucka, and Judd Winnick, while the art tours were divided up, generally on a chapter-by-chapter basis, between the pencil and inker teams of Rags Morales and Michael Baer, Jesus Saez and Jimmy Palmiotti, Ivan Rice and Mark Campos, and Phil Jimenez and Andy Lanning, and artist Ed Benes penciled and inked his chapter on his own. It's a lot of fucking people.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is, we're continuing our DC Crisis / Letdown arc. So, okay, let's do same as we did last week. First thing we should bring up. How did you guys come to this comic the first time you read it? Is this the first time you read it? Did you have any preconceived notions? Like, have you heard about it? What have you been thinking about it?
This is the first time I've read this. And I knew what was going to happen because we've read other... in 52, mm-hmm. we've read stuff about Booster Gold. So, you know, did a little background on him and found out about this. My preconceived notion was that it was going to be a letdown because that's our arc. But I don't know why this would be a letdown. This was really good.
Okay. What about you, David?
So this is not the first time I've read this. I read this, I don't remember when, not when it came out, it was probably 2 or 3 years ago, and I have, in the Booster Gold monthly that spun out of 52, there's a big part where they flash back to this, so I kind of half read it again a couple times, because I read that run a couple times, and so, you know, Blue Beetle is a character I like a lot, and from that perspective, the fact that he's died, it's not like a happy comic, but I don't agree that this is a letdown. I think this is a really well put together story. So
yeah, I okay, maybe we shouldn't have put this one in the letdown series, but this one I want to say that this comic does what I think the other ones tried to do in this Crisis series, especially Identity Crisis, which was to create something that was emotionally heartbreaking, that was going to tear you apart. And they all the other ones failed, whereas this one succeeded at ripping the heart out of your chest and making you hate it. Like, I hate this comic not because of anything it does artistically. I hate this comic because it kills Ted Kord. Which is a little biased.
That's fair.
But yeah, I read this when it first came out. I had no idea what was coming when it happened. And you get there and you're like, oh.
Well, especially on the cover, you can't see, well...
Yeah, on the one that I have here.
Well, yeah, you have the second printing, right? The first printing, he's all blacked out, so you don't even know who it is.
So, knowing the ending, does that make it any less shocking to you guys?
Well, you mean like thinking about it now? Or?
Yeah, like if you've read it a second time, you're looking at it, did it lessen the impact of it the second time around?
I wouldn't call it shocking on... you know, later reads after the first, but it still has a lot of, it's still a pretty, the whole scene where Max reveals himself and they have their conversation and stuff, it's very emotionally powerful because Ted's like not, you know, we spend this whole, the whole thing where Ted explains he talks about what his standing is in the Justice League, and we see it too, how everyone rejects him, nobody wants to help him, and then when it comes down time to face off with the bad guy, he's by himself and he never backs down, even though he knows he's gonna die.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes out you know, it's sad that he dies, but he goes down as a hero, and it sucks that the rest of the Justice League was too stupid to, or too self-absorbed to listen to a guy who they've known for a long time as being an upstanding person, maybe not the best
superhero.
Yeah, and not a heavy hitter or anything like that, but he certainly is not a bad guy and wouldn't mess around in this way.
Yeah, and I love that his final scene is so effective for me because it happens so quick. And when you turn the page, normally when you turn the page and you see the death scene for the hero, it's like this full page spread. It's this big thing. It's this huge deal. But his actual death shot is just like the top fifth of the page, maybe. And it's happened so quick. It's just like, he says, okay, Max, so it's join you or die. And Max says, yeah, pretty much. And he says, go to hell, and then dead. Like, it's literally four sentences back and forth, and that's all it is. It's so, it feels so visceral compared to, like, death scenes for Barry Allen and stuff, where he's, like, on a cosmic treadmill running super fast and his face melts away. Like, it's nothing so dramatic like that.
You know, what's interesting, too, is, like, it's so sudden you keep wondering, okay, how's he going to get out of this? Because they always get out of it, right? You think, you know, Wonder Woman's going to show up now because she believed him or something. And he never gets out. It's just, and it's in silhouette. You see his brains being blown out. And no one survives that.
Yeah.
It's like, there's no chance he made it. There's no way he got out of it. And it's an upheaval of what we're really used to in comics, where the good guy always wins.
Yeah, it's so effective at making you want to cry. So what did you guys think? Okay, let's actually talk about the whole story and everything. I mean, the death scene's obviously the most prevalent thing that comes up. But what did you guys think of, well, I think you put it in the notes, Jen, about having Ted Kord be the narrator for this.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting because it's like he knows where this is leading. And he's leading you along the same path of discovery he did, which makes you, I think, feel really sympathetic towards his plight, too, because he's like, nobody's paying attention to me, and I know there's something going on, and you know it, too, and you just want to, like, take one of the other Justice League members and shake them. Like, listen to this guy! The overall story, I thought, was, like, really mysterious. I the whole time, I was like, what's going to happen next? Who is it? What's happening? And the only thing I wish is that they actually resolved in here a little bit what OMAC was.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, is after this, there's four titles that spin out, and one of them is about the OMAX.
Okay.
See, I really like the Ted Kord as narrator, because I think he has a real earnestness to his character that comes out in his internal monologue that you don't get from a lot of other heroes, or from a lot of other omnipotent narrators, or omniscient narrators, not omnipotent. But, like, I love his descriptions of the other people. Like, when he describes Superman, he says, like, he makes you feel weak and useless and so important at the same time, you know, and, like...
Or it's, like, the first time you've met him. Every time, it's, like, the first time.
Yes. And then, like, what's the other one I like? Like, Starfire, how she just, like, she looks like she radiates, like she's made out of gold or something. Like, these descriptions are one-liners, but they feel so authentic for this character.
Well, I think the reason why it's so effective is because even though Ted's a superhero, he's just the science guy, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he brings a very human perspective to the, you know, to the reader. Like, we can actually relate to him. I mean, even characters like Green Arrow, who are a human, Green Arrow is so over the top in his attitude.
And his facial hair.
Yeah, he's just kind of crazy, kind of, you know. And Booster is, you know, he doesn't have any superpowers either, but he's from the future, and he's kind of kooky, and he's a super arrogant guy. Ted's, like, normal.
Yeah, he's straight up just a dude. Like, even when he was in the JLI, he had a little pot belly.
Mm-hmm.
In the Justice League.
Yeah, they even make, I think Booster makes fun of him in here about that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think so. It's like, no, you look great, thinner than you've been in years. Oh, yeah, and Max orders him the steak, and he doesn't eat it because he's trying to watch his health.
Yeah.
Yeah, the other thing I really liked about him is, I don't know, aside from the descriptions, just the authenticity for the character in general. And him being the narrator, it makes it really, really easy to relate to the story. on so many different aspects. Like the stuff with the magic, because you don't really quite know how magic works, even though there's rules. But he's like, well, fuck it, we'll give it a chance.
And I like how he's kind of like, I hate this crap. You know, it feels very authentic from him. It doesn't feel like if Ollie were to be like, I hate magic. You know, like, of course, Ollie, you hate everything.
And I think that narration pays off at the end. Not like with the Destiny necessarily, but when he's sitting there doing his last internal monologue. Like, when I was rereading it, when I first read this, the thing that got me was when he got shot. Because I was like, no, it's Blue Beetle, I love that man. But when I'm reading this again, knowing that it's going to happen and I can focus on the craft that goes behind the writing and the narration, since you'd put it in the notes, where these last rendering says, my name is Ted Kord, I am the second man to call himself the Blue Beetle, I tell myself there will be a third. And then he says, I hope whoever he or she may be, they do better at it than I have. And I love those four little text boxes.
So sad.
Because I love that there's that idea for superheroes of legacy. Like, he's the second, and he hopes that there will be a third. It's like this idea of, you know, in normal life, you know, we hope that we have kids and our kids will grow up and be more successful than we are and be greater than we are. But then if you're a superhero, you hope that your successor, you hope that your name will get picked up by somebody, that you have done it justice, and that the person to follow you will do it even more justice than you have, that your legacy will endure and grow. And like that idea, I hadn't thought of that way until I read this. And then that line where he says, and I hope the next one will do better than me. I'm like, oh no, but you have done well. You've done so well. You got it right where everybody else got it wrong. They all just wrote you off.
But he knows he's going to die.
Yeah.
And that's so sad.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like he actually comes off, like they're using the trope of the classical Aristotelian hero here. Because he's a man of high stature. Like, he's really wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
He knows exactly where his destiny is leading him, and he follows it anyway, despite what he knows would keep him safe. And it pits, you know, the choice, the personal choice versus the public choice, because he can either sacrifice himself for the greater good or join the bad guys and harm everybody. And the hero, always to their own destruction, chooses the greater good. And it's a struggle against that. And the whole time, he's kind of like, I don't like where this is going. He worries for his friends. Like, you know, he kind of blames himself for Booster getting blown up. And it's, like, really sad.
Yeah, and any number of points along the way, he has multiple places. He could have just sat and hung out until Booster got better. And they could have just hung out and mellowed out and waited for things to cool off. He could have just waited. There's so many times he could have just sat back. And he could have hung out in the Watchtower for, like, a month. Right? And then might not have played out the same way, but that's not the kind of guy he is. He's going to keep chasing it.
And he wasn't willing to put other people in danger after what had already happened. You know, like, he was really upset when Booster was put in the hospital, and I think one of the saddest speeches he gave was when he makes the nurse promise, tell Booster it's not his fault.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he knows exactly what he's going to do, and he's resolved at that moment to do it, and it's just like, you know it's coming and you really don't want it to.
And at that point, he knows Booster is going to blame himself for not having the strength in that moment to stand up and go with him. When it's like, no, dude, you have, what did they say, third-degree burns over 40% of your body? No, dude, you're lucky you even stood up.
It's actually, at some point he says, some people think Booster can know what the future is. Does Booster know what's going to happen?
He has to ask Skeets, and Skeets can find it if there's a record of it.
I mean, it's like, because he's from, was it, the 25th century?
Yeah.
So consider your knowledge of, what is that then, the 1700s? Right, is my math right there?
Wait, what?
So like, oh. Like, so, like him to the 20th century. Like him being in the 25th century versus the 21st.
Oh, right, okay.
Like, how well do we know, how well do we know the 17th century? Or is that the 1800s? It's the 1800s, right?
Yeah, that.
I don't think it's not really. We get what you're
putting. Yeah, not really relevant exactly. But, like, you know, kind of, maybe some of the major events that happened, but, like, come on. I mean, you.
And Booster's not, like, a historian or anything.
No! He was a jock. He was a dumb jock. Like, and I'm not stereotyping jocks, but this is.
But he was a dumb one.
He was the dumb jock stereotype.
Yeah.
That's who he was. And so it's like, of course he's not going to know.
Okay, and then Skeets is gone here because he's been dismantled to spy on them.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so sad.
Because Checkman has to get the technology from somewhere. So, the other thing I want to talk about is all of his rejections. Because it happens quite often, and I like the way that the authors find a way to tell character of the other characters in the story through Ted Kord and his perspective. Like, aside from just his descriptions, like, I find it interesting all the different ways that they find to reject him. Like, the first one that I liked the best was Barbara Gordon, right? She's sitting there saying, Ted Kord, your money's getting siphoned out of your account, you seem really blasé, you don't seem like your head's in the game, you're about to go bankrupt, and you don't seem to give a fuck, and by the way, it's affecting other people, I should be in Metropolis right now. like, dude, you just explained to your friend that his life is going down the shitter, and you're concerned that your plane doesn't get to take off. And then later on, like, you get something equally telling where Diana's there when he wakes up in the watchtower, and she says some really sweet things, and then fucking walks away, and we never see her again.
Yeah.
She's that really sweet dismissiveness that, like, oh, yeah, that's great, and kind of, like, almost patting him on the head.
Ted's in the friend zone.
Yeah. Like, almost patting him on the head like a puppy, and then she leaves, and then never again do we see her. Yep. And then I think the only one that you could really predict the way it happens is Bruce Wayne.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're in my cave. Get out.
Oh, he puts him on hold, and yes. Then, like, Ted hangs up first yes. So that he doesn't get hung up on. That's... I thought the meanest thing, though, was when Martian Manhunter was like, you'll be leaving then mm-hmm. at the Watchtower. Because that's even like, yeah, you can't hang out here. You have to go. Nobody wants you here.
Well, they have history. John Jones doesn't have any love for Booster and Beetle.
I believe that. They're very opposite, so.
Well, they're the pranksters in the JLI.
Right, they stole his cookies.
Yeah.
Wait, is that their gripe?
They have other gripes, but that's the...
That's like the big one.
That's the big one.
That's excellent.
They just... They're pranksters, and their favorite person to fuck with was John.
Okay.
Because, I don't know, they actually had some respect or fear of Bruce Wayne still and Batman, but John they felt like they could fuck with all day long and get away with it, more or less. So what parts of this did you guys like the most, or...
The storytelling. I would say, like, the way that it led you through the plot, where you meet all these people and it's... Like, you're expected to know who Batman and Wonder Woman and Superman are. Like, there'd be no reason that you were reading this comic if you didn't, I think. But at the same time, like, it just kind of explains him, so maybe... I feel like this is a comic I could hand to someone who has not read any of the DC stuff, and it'd be a very self-contained work. Mm-hmm. And it kind of, like, leads you through the mystery, and it has the subtle countdown, where it has, you know, the 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, the chapters going backwards. Mm-hmm. And I think the plot's just well-written as a standalone work.
So did the framing work well for you?
Yeah, like, where you...
Where you see him at the computer at the beginning of every chapter?
You start at the beginning of the action, and you wonder why he's there, and then instead of, you know, leading you on some wild goose chase like other comics do, you know you're getting to the explanation of why he's there and what's happening. And then when we see him in the present, it adds to the weight of everything else that's happening before that.
Because you know that something is up, and you know that he does figure it out. He does get there. What about you, David? Did it work for you, too?
Yeah, I thought it was really effective, because it, you know, there's a lot going on in this comic, and it brings you back to, it's like, don't forget that this is the present back here. Like, yeah, that worked well. And then you guys covered a lot while I was flipping through the comic.
Well, okay, is there a favorite scene that happened in this? I gotta say, it has nothing to do with Blue Beetle. It really doesn't have much of anything to do with this story. But one of the scenes that always sticks out in my mind is the Secret Society of Supervillains. Like, standing around the table and Black Adam floating there. Mm-hmm. And Talia al Ghul getting annoyed with him. And I love his answer. He's like, I've been told to float above... Or I rise above the flock or something. I love that scene, because when everybody asks me what Black Adam is like, I would give this scene as an example. That's who he is. He floats above the flock. And by the way, the flock is Lex Luthor, Talia al Ghul, Vandal Savage.
Deathstroke.
Deathstroke, the Terminator. They're the flock. He floats above them. That scene has always stuck in my mind. And I haven't read this in years, and so I'd forgotten what comic it was from. So when I would describe it to people, they say, oh, what's that in? I say, I don't fucking know. But now I can tell them correctly.
Who's Dr. Psycho?
Dr. Psycho is a big mind control character, but I don't actually know whose primary arch villain he is.
Okay. Because he's sitting at this table with them, and I have no idea who he is.
Yeah, most of the rest of them you can kind of pick a primary nemesis for, but Dr. Psycho, I don't remember.
Okay.
What about you? Is there a scene that's stuck in your head other than Rubio getting shot in the head?
That's the obvious one.
Yeah.
I don't know. I thought the whole scene where he goes to Fawcett City and meets the wizard Shazam was really interesting. But the kind of confusing thing about that scene was I wasn't really sure what the point of that was. Maybe it was the scarab trying to protect itself or find its way out of Blue Beetle's hands because he knows he's going to die or something.
Yeah. I mean,
it kind of tells us more about Beetle's character. And also we see that even a character like the wizard, who is pretty, I don't want to say he's omniscient, but he's pretty well informed, I guess you could say, also just completely disregards him.
I don't know. I felt like it actually made him seem more special because he says, like, nobody sees the wizard Shazam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, except, nobody sees them except for the Marvels and they're the mightiest mortals.
Yeah, and, like, it's like a privilege to see the wizard. Then again, the wizard does jack his scarab.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, steals the scarab, kicks him out. But I think part of the reason the scene is in here, obviously, is because DC knows that they're killing this Blue Beetle and they need a plot device for the next one. And, spoiler, this scarab and this scene is directly related to the next Beetle.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I haven't actually read Jaime Reyes' like origin story. So I don't know how he gets the scarab, actually.
Yes, but they are directly related. So, I mean, okay. There's editorially, there's a functional point to that scene. But I think it also does show for character how queasy he is with all that magic crap.
Yeah.
When I looked it up, Dr. Psycho is a Wonder Woman villain.
Oh.
Which is probably why none of us have heard of him. So sad.
Yeah.
Poor Wonder Woman, such an awesome character and always so neglected. So what about you? Did you have a scene?
In terms of, like, a favorite, I would have to say where he's saying goodbye to Booster. It was just heart-wrenching because you know what's happening. But I don't know, I thought there were a lot of little things in it that were nice. Where he goes home with Booster and Booster, comments on the scarab and it kind of unfolds so much of their relationship. Because all he says is, I haven't told him I found it yet. And Booster's like, so how long have you had that? And suddenly you're like, oh, these guys were supposed to be best buds, but there's clearly a rift that happened here. And it just, it's like two lines reveal so much about their characters. So I really liked that, too.
Yeah, I love all of the scenes with Booster and Beetle together. Just because that scene's great because you know quickly how close that they were, that Beetle's not looking at Booster. Throughout most of that scene, they're not looking at each other. Beetle's at the computer and Booster's fucking around in the apartment, right? And as he's narrating, Beetle's saying, he's looking at the scarab. He's going to ask me about the scarab. Then he asks about the scarab. It's like he knows his friend that well. And Booster feels comfortable enough to poke around his bud's apartment and knows the things that are there that weren't supposed to be there. And feels comfortable making the comments about, oh man, we were handsome, right? Even John Jones had that thing going on, that bald machismo.
Yeah.
You know, and then that's the one side of their friendship. And then the other side, I love that you get both of them too, is when Booster decides to leave for Miami and ditch him on the street, on the sidewalk. And Beetle says, well, gotta look out for yourself, right, Booster? Which is something that Booster would go, yeah, you do. That would be his motto. And then he jabs him and says, it's what you're best at, buddy. That's knowing your friend and knowing how to hit him where it hurts.
Yeah.
You know, and that shows you the rift that's between them now, too.
Hmm. I was just leafing through looking for other scenes, and one thing, I will say, like, there was a scene in here that I did not like, and it's where Batman's talking to Alfred, and he's like, I know what they did to me. And it felt so overdramatic, because it's like...
There's another scene like that with Dr. Light also.
Oh, yeah. God, yeah. He
basically says the exact same thing, right?
But he, like, it's already established that he knew, and then we kind of implicitly know that Batman knows. And I feel like it's better with Batman if they just kind of left it where we're supposed to assume he's such a good detective, he knows.
Yeah.
That adds to his character, whereas this is, like, corny.
I think this is residual overdramatization. Because Identity Crisis was so overdramatic and crappy that whenever they refer to it, it feels overdramatic and crappy. Like, because it is. It's just one line at the bottom of a page. I know what they did to me. Or was it? Was it like a half page? I think it was like a half page.
Yeah, it's like a half page.
But it's like, come on, that's not that bad. The reason it feels crappy is because it's like such a blatant tie-in to this overdramatic piece of junk. The same thing with the Dr. Light scene. You get this nice interaction with all this secret society of supervillains, and they're talking, and things are being said that actually matters by people who you should give a fuck about. And then there's Dr. Light. And what about me? My retribution! You know, Lex Luthor's just like, chill the fuck out, bro. We'll handle this, and then you can, you know, clap from the corner. Like, it's so much pomp and circumstance over so little substance. I mean, mind rape and all that, but you know what I mean.
Well, Dr. Light's stupid. Like, he was the worst character to choose to do this to. You know, they could have picked someone a little more threatening or someone a little less tacky.
Yeah, but that's... I think he's kind of... He's the other side of the coin of what DC is doing with Identity Crisis and with this, too. They were trying to make the statement that these little characters that aren't the titles to the books are actually... They're the real linchpins of the DC universe. Like,
no,
Blue Beetle... That's what they were trying to say. And, like, okay, if you say that Blue Beetle is this important, Blue Beetle's the one that can figure it out, or nobody else can, and Blue Beetle can be this important. He can make this occasion happen, and he can rise to it and be the only one who figures it out. Then you have to have the villain side of it, too.
Well, didn't Blue Beetle at least get his own title at some point?
Oh, yeah, he's had it a couple times.
In the 80s.
Yeah, well,
someone thought he was important enough. No one's ever going to make a title for Dr. Light.
Dr. Light's been a huge Teen Titans villain, for whatever that matters,
awful.
For a while. Teen Titans, but... He was a nemesis for somebody.
I don't know, I just want to put forth, like, imagine...
For kids.
For kids, yeah.
If instead of Dr. Light... It was Black Adam or someone. Like, that'd be fucking menacing.
You mean who did the...
Like, if Black Adam were the crazy rapist who is...
Yeah, but...
But see, that's the thing, is they can't do that.
It's so menacing, though.
They have
it's
to
scary.
Pick somebody who, like, is irrelevant to continuity. They can't pick, like, Black Adam because he's the kind of guy who would get the title for his own book.
That's in his character, and that's why I'm okay with that.
Yeah, but I don't know if that is in his character. I don't think Black Adam is a racist.
No, he would never.
He's
a
definitely
racist.
He's definitely racist. I don't think he's a rapist.
No,
because
he has very high morals. I mean, we see it in 52.
Yeah,
when he protects the people of Kandak.
He has selective morals.
He does bad things, but he thinks he's doing them for the right reasons. He thinks he's doing the right thing by doing bad stuff.
In his mind, the end justifies the means.
Yeah.
And there's no end or means or anything for him that's right about rape. Right? Like, in order to be okay with rape, you just have to be a corrupt, fucked up dude. And that's, I mean, of everybody at this table, that's only Dr. Light.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe Dr. Psycho, because he has mind control stuff with, well, yeah, Dr. Psycho would have been a good one, but nobody knows who the fuck that is. As if anybody knew who Dr. Light was.
I knew who Dr. Light was. I didn't know who Dr. Psycho was.
Well, I think we know who Dr. Light is because he's a rapist.
Well, I knew of him from outside of that. I mean,
yeah, I think I heard of him first with the rape. See, Deathstroke would have been a good... Looking at this table,
yeah,
Deathstroke
okay.
would have been a good
no,
call.
No, he would. I
no?
think he would be a bad choice, too.
Why?
Because he flip-flops, right? Sometimes he's good. And he's a dad.
Okay.
That's true. He has a daughter.
Yeah.
That's true.
And he already had his creeper moment.
Wait, which one?
He had like some kind of weird relationship with Tara.
Oh, that's right. He was like 16.
Yeah, he does statutory rape.
Statutory rape of a teen titan. Yes.
Well, she was a bad guy anyway.
Yeah.
Questionable. Maybe it should have been Alfred, because it's always the butler. No, I mean, either way you look at it, it doesn't fit in comics.
It has to be some creepy guy who likes fighting children, right? God. It has to be like a Teen Titans or a Young Justice villain or something creepy, skeevy feeling like that.
I guess it could have been maybe one of Flash's rogues, too.
Yeah, like a... Not Len Snart, not like Captain Cold,
no,
but
like Trickster.
Master.
No, not Mirror Master. He's just,
yeah, he's the druggy guy.
I think it would be
like
the Pied Piper or something.
No, Pied Piper's gay.
Is he? I don't know.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Pied Piper's gay. But like the top, the guy who runs around.
Or maybe Trickster.
Like seriously, all the top does is he spins really fast and he shouts, "Nothing tops the top." He would be a rapist. I believe that.
Okay, now we're talking about last week's comic.
Oh, I have derailed us. Okay.
Okay. It's fine. It's an okay tangent.
Yeah. I mean, it's connecting the two episodes, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Continuity.
Yeah.
We has it almost as much as DC. Aw.
So we were talking about scenes.
Yes.
Where Booster gets the money out of the ATM.
Yeah.
Does he decide to just throw it in the air and let it rain down?
No, I think
there was a mild breeze and his thumb wasn't on the money.
It was the bug.
Oh, it was the bug coming down.
Okay.
Okay.
I totally, like, he looked so sad about how poor he was, and then it looked like he had a doubt and was like, fuck it, and threw it in the air.
See, but the reason that doesn't connect is because that happens, and then there's a full page of, like, nostalgia, and then you see the bug. So you don't get the connect the way that you're supposed to.
Okay.
And we never see him pick it up. I don't know.
That's okay, it's Ted's.
It's Ted's money, fuck it, it can stay on the ground.
He's like, Ted, you dropped your money.
You dropped your money, I'm keeping the card. God, though, that scene was so sad.
You know what scene is sad? The one where they're eating lunch with Max. Because Max is sitting there feeding these two, knowing what's about to go down.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He's an asshole.
Yeah.
Like, I think he's, like, one of the biggest assholes in all of the DCU.
He's a used car salesman.
And you know what's worse? Spoiler alert, he dies at the end of Infinite Crisis. And then the motherfucker gets resurrected.
Yeah. Ugh. Yeah, that is.
He's a huge asshole, but I think he makes a good villain.
Yes, because he will do just this sort of thing, and it's at a point in the comic where if you don't know the outcome, you don't know how creepy this is. You don't know how off-putting this should feel, because it feels natural. It feels like two guys catching up with an old friend who's still busier than maybe he should be, trying to scam some money from somebody. Right? It feels just like. Just like it did in the old days.
You know what's odd? Like, I knew Maxwell Lord shot Ted Kord, yet I saw them at lunch and I was just like, this guy's a douche. But I didn't really think beyond it to that. I think they make him not a suspect really strongly at first, and it works even if you know the outcome a little.
And I think his being a douche works in his favor for character, right? You know, in that you don't expect the douchey guy to transition to the evil guy because it's too cliche.
And he's like an evil mastermind, not like a bank robber.
No.
Or some kidnapper who wants ransom or anything. This guy is trying to take down all the superhumans.
Yeah, he took over a superhuman policing organization, a worldwide organization, like a government organization. He rose to the top of that so that he could then take down all of the superheroes at once using those resources. That's a fucking vendetta.
He's a little like Lex Luthor, you know? Like, he really thinks he's doing the right thing, but clearly does not feel like he has to worry about the means of doing it.
I think the difference between him and Lex, though, is Lex is very driven by a personal vendetta with Superman.
Yeah.
Max thinks he's protecting the human race.
Yeah, I mean...
He thinks he has some righteousness behind him.
Luther thinks the same, but it's more like I'm protecting everyone from Superman, which is... It comes out dumb, because there's no need to protect anyone from Superman. I kind of see Maxwell Lord's point, though. Like, you look at... The Justice League does a lot of good stuff for the world, but have you seen, like, the amount of just kind of side destruction that happens even in this comic where no one's really fighting? Mm-hmm. It's like things are blowing up everywhere. Superheroes are trouble.
Yeah, like the bug explodes in the middle of that intersection after Beetle lands it in an intersection like it ain't no thing. Then yes. It blows up and he like walks away. There's like, I mean, we can't... I guess it wouldn't make for a good story if we went through the whole rigmarole with the like cleanup crew coming and stuff, but I mean, there's a lot of collateral damage.
I've heard that there is a comic about the team of people that does that.
It's a Marvel. I don't remember what it's called. I want to say Damage Inc., but I know that's a Metallica song.
I assume it's got to be related to She-Hulk, then, if it's Marvel, right? Because who do you think does all the legal stuff for...
Oh, Damage Control.
Damage Control, that's what it was.
Oh, yeah, look at the cover. This is
The cover of the first one.
Cover for Damage Control number one has Superman and Thor leaving. Or not Superman.
Spider-Man.
And Spider-Man saying, it's all yours, guys. And it's like this just knocked over building.
I could see that being a pretty cool comic if it was done right.
So obviously these people exist, at least in the Marvel Universe.
Oh, I'm sure it's public works here, at least. It's probably rolled into their taxes.
Yeah.
Which sucks for Fawcett City.
Oh, apparently Hercules did community service with Damage Control.
See, if you could write that well, oh my god.
Oh, they need to bring that back. He did community service with Damage Control before, but in the comic, he is a regular employee.
Nice.
I want to read that now. We should put that on a list.
Okay.
Yeah, open up the notes and put that on a list. All right. That sounds amazing.
Should we talk about the art?
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, last week I was complaining about the ink work and how it was so dark and foreboding and we should worry and feel bad. This is really heavy inking too, and I think this is it done right. Because, I mean, honestly, the art itself is not super different from last week's in terms of style and tone, but it fits with the tone of this comic so much better because it doesn't feel overwrought. It doesn't feel like this is dark because this comic is dark. This is dark because there's a mystery that we need to shine light upon.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of brightness, too. Like, when you see the heroes, it's like color, light. When Green Lantern shows up, like, bam, he's green!
Well, there's a panel that's just like Ted Wash in green.
And that's actually probably how it feels if Green Lantern's hanging out right next to you. It's probably like, someone's messing with my lighting and this is annoying.
See, and then his description of Hal, and that ring of his, just seeing it makes me try to stand a little bit taller. Like, come on. I love those. But yeah, and honestly, until I looked it up for the intro of this episode, I had no idea how many artists and inkers worked on this comic.
Yeah,
insane.
It flows really well together. There wasn't like, oh man, I can tell that this is a different artist now. Like if Mike Mignola or someone was thrown in there, you would see it, but...
I mean, there's some changes that you can tell. Like in the first issue, the out-of-costume eyes are like awkwardly large, and then later on they kind of rein it back into normal, but it's like... just small anatomy inconsistencies, but it's nothing that's like... there's no major stylistic differences. There's not even anything that makes you raise your eyebrows. I mean, that's just something that kind of changes over time a little bit. And even then, it's negated by the fact that Blue Beetle has these fucking giant-ass goggles for his costume. So it's like, well, big eyes, big eyes, big eyes. It's a big eye comic, whatevs.
Manga.
Yes, it's a manga. But, like, it amazes me how well the art in this flows for it having 9 artists over 80 pages.
Yeah, it's harmonious. I'd say, like, I never would have guessed. In fact, I didn't look up the artist credits or the writer credits before I read this, and when you read off the list, I was like, wow, I thought it was one guy.
You know, I actually thought Dr. Light's costume looked cool in this.
Yeah.
Because the white parts kind of glow.
His costume was cool in Identity Crisis as well. It's just, he's so stupid.
Yeah.
It, like, detracts from his art.
Yeah. See, anyone always confuses me with Dr. Light. Isn't there... there's a superhero named Dr. Light,
mm-hmm.
who's a member of the Justice League,
mm-hmm.
with almost the exact same costume, but on a girl.
Yep. Well, she's from Countdown to Infinite Crisis.
Yeah, I don't... Hiroshi...
Yeah, she's a Japanese lady. I don't remember what her last name is.
Yeah.
But she has nearly the exact same powers and almost the exact same costume, right?
Yeah. I don't know if she's, like, related to him or something, or just, like... Man, no. That supervillain from the Titans. I want to take up his mantle, but be a good guy.
No, she was like a physicist, and she somehow gained light powers in... Oh, Kimio Hoshi. She gained light powers during Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Hmm.
But...
Yeah, but
she's an actual doctor. She's an actual medical doctor.
Oh, how cool.
She's straight up a real doctor.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, but it's weird. I don't know how I got on that tangent. I have no idea.
So
we're talking about his costume.
Oh, yeah.
I want to point out a really cool costuming thing. When he's fighting the... Oh, who are they? The Mad Men.
Mm-hmm.
They all look kind of like multicolored Jokers. There's really good color in those panels. If you look at it, it's like the very stark green, yellow, red, blue that you see in... old school comics, and it has this very, like, we're back in 1960 vibe to it. And it makes them feel, like, really cool and classic, and, I mean, then you're kind of like, well, why are they jumping him? But, like, I feel like for such odd villains, they kind of captured a really neat tone for them with the art.
And I think they're effective for part of the vibe of this comic. I mean, even though it ends with this character's death, and even though there's some parts of this that are obviously spin-off-y editorial-wise in terms of direction, there's something about this comic that does feel like that nostalgic idea of what old comics were. Like the story of there's a big story, there's these huge events that happen, there's the big players in the universe. It feels like there's some big story here, and we're getting a piece of it. And it feels like those big stories don't happen the way that they used to, you know? There's no more Age of Apocalypse or whatever in X-Men stories, or at least it doesn't feel like there are. And this has that kind of feel again. Like, there's some big story, there's some big thing that's going on, and this motherfucker's gonna figure it out. Ominous events, big stakes, all that kinds of good stuff. And this lends itself to that, I think.
Yeah. It seems... a good time to rate this.
Yeah, I know. We're just kind of going around in circles at this point.
It's hard to talk about things we enjoy. As
yes.
odd as that sounds.
Then you can go first.
Okay. Oh, man. I'm going to give this a 4.5. I loved it. I was in a discussion with a friend yesterday about high points and low points of comics and how, as a medium, you know, it's pretty non-standard. There's stereotypes of, like, goofy things that you see in comics, and then sometimes you just come across a work that's really, really good. And if I knew someone who was trying to get into comics and was like, give me a good story with likable characters, you know, something I'll get really attached to and that will get me into this, I would hand them this. Because it is... You don't need to know who any of these people are to enjoy this, I think. This is my first time reading Blue Beetle, and I loved him. From the very first moment you see him, like, he's just a likable character when he's describing himself and what his parents called him. Like, you know he's a super genius on the first page, that he can hack really well, and, you know, you kind of get this really good picture of who he is, and you get attached. And when he dies at the end, it feels very much like a complete story. It's super sad. It was, like, the worst. But this is super sad, horrible, done right. You know, this is the writer kicking you in the head really hard with a steel-toed boot. But you kind of like it because it was a fun ride right before the kick. And that's, as you said earlier, kind of what Identity Crisis was trying to do and failed pretty badly at. The, like, oh, we feel bad all the time.
And she was pregnant.
Oh, God. But it's like, here, you know, you get this mystery, and at the end you're like, how is he going to get out of it? He's got to solve it. And then he can't. No one knows. He can't alert anyone. It's over, and it's done, and it's sad, but it's such a good story. So yeah, 4.5.
Okay. David?
Hmm.
Stroke the beard.
Well, I've sugar my beard before. But anyways, I will agree with Jen and say 4.5. It was, like I said before, I had read a lot of Blue Beetle stuff before this. Like, I had read JLI and then Identity Crisis before I came to this. So by that time, I was pretty well attached to Blue Beetle. So from that perspective, it's pretty sad. But the story as a whole is just, it's so engaging, and it keeps you into it through the whole, all 80 pages, and it's tight, and there's not much fluff, and the art's good, and I don't know, it's a really good comic. It's not a perfect comic. I think it would be really hard to make a perfect comic, but yeah, it's really good. And the stuff that comes out of it, I mean, Infinite Crisis is a good story, so. Like Jen said, it's a good place for a new person to start, even though the most likable character in it dies at the end.
But if you like Ted Kord, is 30 years of comics you can go back.
Yeah, fortunately, and read. Comics, you don't have to read them in order.
Yeah.
It helps, but you don't have to.
Yeah. Oh, I go back and forth with my head with this comic all the time.
Rate it as a story, not as the death of Blue Beetle.
See, but I cannot separate those two. Because having been such a fan of Justice League International and Blue Beetle and Booster Gold and that team that they were part of back in the 80s, I mean, being so tied to them, Blue Beetle's a character that everybody loves. I don't know anybody who's, like, you say, oh, what about Blue Beetle? I fucking hate that guy. Nobody would have ever said that. Or nobody would ever say he's annoying. Nobody would ever say anything about Blue Beetle. And story-wise, him being such a dejected character is what makes this work. You know, you can't have this story be about, say, Power Girl, because everybody in the DCU respects her. So, I mean, it has to be somebody like Blue Beetle, somebody that they have forgotten, just as well as all the readers have forgotten. But I feel like you didn't have to kill Ted Kord. You know, you can write a story about a forgotten character that's not somebody that everybody universally loves. I mean, fuck, you can kill Hawkman. Nobody cares about Hawkman. You can kill fucking Speedy, Red Arrow, whatever the fuck his name is, instead of making him like...
Arsenal.
Yeah, Arsenal, whatever the fuck he ends up being in Rise and Fall. You know, like, okay, maybe if you try to do it with a character that people are annoyed with, you get Rise and Fall, but I think that was just a case of bad writing, and this is just a case of good writing. And I think that you could have made this an effective story with somebody less universally loved, but then do you get the same emotional punchline at the end? If they killed Hawkman at the end of this, I would not have given a fuck. I wouldn't have cared. But because it was somebody I loved, after I read this, I stopped buying comics for about 4 years. Like, all comics. I went to the comic shop and I said, well, delete my name off the pull list. Just take it off. I don't need to read this anymore. I was like, after Identity Crisis, DC's trying to do this thing where they're dark and gritty, and it's not what I want to read. It's not in my interest. It's not what comics I want to read. It's nothing I want. If I want to read a superhero comic, then I want something like JLI. If I want to see gritty realism, I'm not going to pick up a DC comic. It felt like they were winnowing away and destroying a genre and trying to pass it off as a good thing. But coming back to it now, it still is a good story. It's well done, and maybe what makes it work is that it is Blue Beetle. As much as I hate to say that, maybe that's what makes it work, is that it is this character, and that you couldn't tell this story with anybody else. So, after rambling to try and put it off, I still haven't thought of a number. 4. I'm going to say 4.
Okay.
It probably should be 4.5, but I'm going to make it a 4 out of spite.
That's a pretty good spite rating.
Yeah, I know, right? It's a really good comic. Even with a 4. So yeah, that's
before,
it.
Before we wrap it up, should we bring up Batman's ear?
Yeah, so the cover of this comic, we've been talking about this the last couple weeks that we've been looking at it. The cover of this comic, Batman's ear is fucking massive.
And you guys can totally see it through the cowl.
I know, I didn't notice this. David pointed it out first. And then when he pointed out, I looked at the other covers with Batman that I own. And the ear never sticks up out of the cowl. It's always, like, underneath the rubber. But here, like, the shaped rubber of the cowl, like, has the ear sticking out from the cowl. I've never seen it before. And he has a big ear. It's like half of his head.
It's like it's jumping insane. Off the page.
It's insane. So yeah, take a look at the cover of this if you don't. Like if you read it in trade or something, but I think I don't know if this is collected anywhere. It probably is.
This is one of those things that can't be unseen, by the way. You'll always notice that Batman doesn't have an ear.
Anywhere else but here. And here he has an ear, and is huge. So, yes, ear. That's it for this week, then. Next week, we're going to read Final Crisis and wrap up our quote-unquote letdown arc. Final Crisis came out a couple years after this, but a couple years before right now.
Here, I have it in my hand. So,
Next week, we're going to read Final Crisis. Came out in 2008. It collects Final Crisis 1-7, Final Crisis Superman Beyond 1 and 2, Final Crisis Submit number 1, and Final Crisis Sketchbook. I don't think you need to buy the sketchbook. I think it's just the sketches in the back. But they're collected in a weird order. You're gonna wanna look that up on Amazon or something. But if you want to get to the link of exactly the trade that we're talking about, you can find that on our website at www.atomicpoweredsupercast.com. You go to the little button on the right that says Future Shows, and it should be right there, a little picture of the Final Crisis cover, and you click on Amazon just below it, boom, it takes you straight to the page where you can buy it, or look and see what issues it collects in what order. You can also always ask us directly, in case you're still not sure, over email.
Which is atomicpoweredsupercast@gmail.com.
And as always, you can ask us or just talk to us, whatevs, about anything. It's cool. I'm here if you want to chat. On the social medias, that's twitter.com/APSupercast and facebook.com/APSupercast. And as always, please subscribe to us on
iTunes.
And actually, last week I went ahead and got us listed on Stitcher. Just Stitcher Radio, which apparently you can listen to on like TVs and in cars and stuff. So we're on that now.
How cool.
I don't know how it works yet. I just know that we're on it now. I went ahead and submitted the stuff, and we're on it. I have to figure out how it works, so I can tell you people how it works, in case you want to listen to it in a car or something. But that'll be next week, maybe. I don't know, maybe the week after, I'll let you know. Either way, it's on the website. I've posted links to it on the social medias. If you follow us, then you already know. Alright, so then until next week.
Goodbye!